Hi, Grace.
Good morning, Karina. How are you doing?
I'm really good, thank you. I'm kind of pinching myself that we have this chat today. Well, it's your morning, it's my evening.
Yes, that's true.
Yes, I'm so excited to go wherever we go in this conversation. I've been admiring you from afar for so long and just loving everything that you do. And every time you do something new, I just think, oh my God, that's amazing. Sometimes I feel like the things that you're doing, it's almost like you're reaching into my brain or my heart and but actually bringing it into being. So thank you so much for saying yes to this. It's such an honor.
Well, thank you. That's a really, really beautiful introduction. And I think you've actually touched on something very, very pivotal in what you've said there about the touching into kind of the collective movement. I often think that this body of work that I'm bringing into the world is not all mine. In fact, I see very much that I am the body, that the work comes through. And so there is something interesting in what you said about kind of there is a tapping, I think, into that is not my doing. And it's been a really interesting journey just to allow the work to come out and trust that it actually is responding to needs, wants, visions that far exceed, this small island on the west coast of Europe where I happen to be at the minute. So I think there's some real truth in that.
Yes. And if you can't tell from the beautiful accent, that is Ireland that Grace is talking
Yes, that is.
about.
Yeah.
Grace, I'd love to start by just handing it over to you, and I'd love to hear what's your yoga story? How did you come to yoga, and how did that lead you to yin yoga?
Okay, right. Sit tight now for a nice tension of opposites story. First came to yoga, gosh, going on 18 years ago, early 20s. And friend brought me along to a new class that she was trying in Dublin because a Bikram yoga studio had just opened. And that was my very first introduction to yoga asana as a practice. And it was a practice that I still continue to practice to this day. It was my entry point. For many years, it was the only practice that I did until I got curious about kind of what else was out there. And tried, I mean, obviously not everything that was available, but pretty close. Ashtanga and power and a lot of different flow classes, a lot of various different, I mean, Bikram is a hatha practice, but a kind of non-heated hatha practices as well. And then got very much into kind of more of the stillness side of things from a meditation perspective, but didn't know anything about yin at that point. When I went to actually do my first teacher training in 2013, it was a Bikram teacher training that I did. And that was for me when I started teaching yoga full time. I was actually in New Zealand. I kind of started my full time teaching journey in the Southern Hemisphere. It wasn't until I actually started teaching that I became aware of yin. And so I had this whole background, which was very, I'm going to use the word yang, and I think that probably your listeners are familiar with these two terms, but I make it very simple, far simpler than your expertise and certainly your traditional Chinese background. You might wince a little bit at this simplified definition, but when I'm explaining it just to people in terms of yoga, when I talk about yin, I really speak about practices that are still. And when I speak about yang yoga, I make it very kind of, gross in its definition that when there is contraction of muscles, when there is essentially and some movement, and generally those two go together. And so I came very much from a yang background, only discovered yin as a practice when I was very firmly, only kind of in the Bikram world. And it was that very first yin class. It brought me back to my very first Bikram class, because I think there was something in the capacity of those two practices to take you very close to the core of who you are, who I am. There was a recognition in both of them that they were both containers for a fabulous path of self-awareness, of self-knowledge, and of self-actualization. And that continues to be the thread that for me brings the two of them together and actually makes them a lot more similar than you might think at first glance, I suppose. So look, that's how, you know, the Bikram journey then gave way to yin, and I continued. I obviously trained in yin in 2015 and did a lot, you know, went down quite deep that rabbit hole and got very much into Vipassana meditation as a result of training with Sarah Powers, and went very deeply into Paul Grilly's functional lineage through my trainings with one of his assistants, Nisan, who's actually based in Australia as well, north of Sydney. And I guess what I can say is that my own journey through practice and through teaching has been can be summed up in the word integration, which is a big part of my teaching now. This understanding that that yoga as a practice of wholeness is just as much about embracing aspects of ourselves that we'd rather, you know, not, as it is about reaching and striving for some kind of better, lighter, and brighter version, and which I think can sometimes be the more dominant discourse in yoga land, so to speak. So have I covered bits of it there?
I'm curious about how one would be like quite submerged in that Bikram sphere. I started with Bikram as well, so I find that really interesting. How yin would have even come on your radar in the first place, and what might have inspired you to try a class like that, because it would have been the polar opposite of what you were really into at the time.
Yeah, totally. And do you know, I think it's a case of that for I practiced for a long time before I went to training. And it's an interesting thing, because I suppose I see now a much quicker route that many people maybe start practicing yoga, and sometimes within 6 months they're embarking on teacher training. I mean, it took me 8 years, and the seed was planted much earlier. I wanted to do it, but it was expensive, and I didn't want to take out a loan. I kind of wanted to give myself time to save up the money to pay for it. And I had to, at the time I was teaching in school, and so I had to apply for time off, and there were just a few logistical things that kind of delayed that process. But it really, I think, stood to me in the long run, because it gave me many years for me to explore my practice before I had to share it with others. It's a huge point, actually, because meeting teachers and training teachers and seeing how much they often struggle to maintain their self-practice after they do their training, I often wonder, do they struggle because it was never maybe established to begin with, or not to the same degree, you know, not for the same length of time. But I think after 8 years of a solid solid enough regular practice plus training, I landed in Auckland. I was teaching a lot. And I think my there was just a genuine sense of this is not all of it. This is not it by any stretch of the imagination. And also my body needs something different, needs a space of quiet introspection. And I would have, I'm an introspective person by nature, but it wouldn't have been somatic. It wouldn't have been a body-based introspective practice. And I think that's also an unusual maybe point to make, that, you know, I think being someone who's, you know, comfortable in my own company and quite solitary even at times, I'm no stranger to kind of self-examination, but there's a massive difference to engaging in that sort of practice, you know, when it's kind of very head directed, and when you are settling into the wisdom of the body and engaging in that kind of self inquiry. And that's a pivotal point, I think, to make when we, you know, go on to where yin brings in its magic. But ultimately, I think my body was just calling for something different. And a friend, and actually one of the karma yogis in the Bikram Yoga Studio in Bryn Mawr had come in one day and said that she'd heard about some class that was at a different studio, and it was yin yoga, and I hadn't a clue what it was, but she'd heard great things, and we went along together, and it was a Sunday afternoon class. And I recall to this day the feeling of practicing it and knowing right down to the core of my bones, the same way I knew about Bikram, actually, knowing that it was a practice that I would continue to do for the rest of my life and likely share with others at some point as well. So with both Bikram and Yin, I had that knowing in the very, very first practice. And it's a funny thing when you feel the body, soul, the body, mind, psyche, I mean, it's all, you know, all interconnected, is communicating with you in a very deep way, from the belly. And that was my first, I suppose, understanding that there is a belly voice that is a true me voice, as opposed to the many voices that can be operational in my head on any given day. And so that's another journey that yin can allow you to explore, I think, too.
Oh my gosh, you just said so many lovely things. I'd love to piece out of that.
Okay.
Well, the first thing I wanted to kind of reflect back was when you talk about yogis becoming teachers really quick. I've heard you talk about that, and obviously it's a conversation I've had with people as well. You had a really great episode on your podcast. Grace has an amazing podcast, which we'll pop in the notes. And it was a dialogue that you were having with somebody who I think did a training with you. And they'd sort of had the wool pulled off their eyes. And the flavor of the conversation that I could hear was one of a bit of shock and a bit of dismay that this beautiful kind of golden orb that she'd felt was there in the yogaverse kind of wasn't. And it was, I mean, all of those episodes that you've got on that podcast are just brilliant because it's so raw and it's so real. And it's another thing that I really admired about you is what a great project. But that particular episode really stood out to me because of that I think you just said, that maybe like people are just so quick to become. People just want to maybe become a master very quickly. And we're living in an age now where things are so fast that we skip over that.
Absolutely. Oh, I remember that episode so well, and that was, the kind of the word was, you know, just a disappointment. I think you really touched that. That's exactly what it was, a kind of a sense of, gosh, like I really didn't know that it was like this. And I think it's a recent development. And then I say recent, but I mean, you know, the last probably 20 years at the same time has seen, and actually since, I mean, Bikram would have been a massive contributor to this. So I can speak as having been someone who was part of that mass teacher training journey. Like, I mean, there were 315 people on my training in 2013, and there were two a year. So there were, I think, about 400 people on the one in spring, and I was there in the fall. 700 plus teachers, and that was just in Bikram. Now, you know, there were so many other kind of mass teacher trainings, and there were two massive consequences, I think, from those. A was the first was that there was this kind of factory line approach whereby you get them all in a batch, we'll train everyone up together, and we'll get them out. And this kind of machine-like in out, I mean, very capitalist, I mean, very much focused on the profitability of a process such as that, number one. Secondly, And this is very specific to the functional approach. When you are training batches of people, you end up with an extremely standardized view of not just anatomy, but just the body and existence and human beings across the board. And so what is shared and taught on mass trainings is, I mean, very often it just leaves, you know, someone like me when I come along, I guess, and work with people on a more detailed level with just a hell of a lot to undo with people, a hell of a lot of unlearning to engage in, which I love in many ways. It is what I think education really is. It's the process of unlearning all the things that you thought and were true and that others have maybe taught were true. But it's hard work. It's hard work to try to undo and unlearn with people so many things that they have learned that they are very deeply attached to because their teachers were very deeply attached to them because they depended on it for their livelihood. And also probably were real very much partaking in this view of there being a right way. You know, this right way to do things has sadly caused a huge amount of both division in the yoga world and also contributed to a very rapid kind of instant gratification whereby we want everything yesterday. You know, we want to sign up for something, but we want it to be super short. So I want to do a training, but I want it to be 4 hours, pre-recorded if possible, so I can do it in my own time. Don't want to meet any live teacher. Don't want to do homework. Don't want to be assessed. Don't want to get feedback. So I would kind of ask, well, where's the teaching actually? So I think that process of everything being delivered in shorter amounts of time has contributed massively to the teacher training world losing a lot of its value and maybe a lot of its education en route.
Yes. A couple of things to that. One, I think until it's sort of brought to someone's awareness, when you're in a class with a teacher that you deeply respect and they say things with conviction in such absolutes over and over and over again, you don't even know how deeply ingrained it's going into your psyche until you start parroting it as well. And it's not until someone flags it with you that you start examining your own words and ask yourself, what do I really mean by that? What am I actually saying? Do I know what that means? Could I find my own way to say it? And if I find my own way to say it, do I really stand behind it? Oh, and that can be a really frightening moment, you know. And I've also been someone who's participated in mass teacher training batches of students. You know, I worked at a yoga college for 6 or 7 years, and we would have year-long programs. And you'd find that people were enrolling and they'd only been practicing yoga for 6 months or a year. And there wasn't really an assessment process. It was really, hey, if you want to do it, come along. And now it's shorter and shorter, right? I'm not sure if it's the same in Ireland, but like a 200-hour training now is long, whereas we thought 350 was bare bones minimum.
Bare bones minimum. 500 for me was always the bare bones minimum. And maybe that's because the Bikram yoga training that I did first was, it was 9 weeks. It was 500 hours. And I still saw that as the very first step on a longer journey. And I think what's interesting is just to see how the individual perspective, I suppose, plays out in this, because there are it's so interesting just to, you know, I've only again seen another layer of this in terms of what you consider is sufficient. Because I have colleagues, I mean, I call them colleagues not because I work with them, but just colleagues in that they work in the same sphere, shall we say. And they might be running a 200-hour teacher training when they themselves have only done a 200-hour teacher training. And in their logic, if they have one, or in their process of deliberation, nowhere is there kind of the reflection that, you know, that maybe that's not sufficient, or maybe if I've only done 200 hours, the chances of me being able to hold a container and teaching for someone else to go through that journey, you know, that thought doesn't seem to be preventative. And I think then I'm probably on the other extreme. I don't necessarily think that my approach is better. I think it's probably excessively cautious, but I would be someone who always thinks that I'm not ready, and that I have more to learn, and that I can always be learning more. And I can, but that doesn't mean that I'm not able to do the job that I'm doing now. So it's that kind of Dunning-Kruger, you know, effect, whereby those who have maybe the least expertise often have the most confidence, and those who maybe have a huge background that is supportive of the work they're doing, know how much they don't know. And it's an interesting thing, you know, and people meet you where they are. And if you really believe you're an expert, well, then you are going to meet the work you're doing with confidence and genuinely believe that the words that you're saying are the truth. And I think even though I might have studied and explored things from many, many angles and feel fairly sure about what I'm saying, I hardly ever present anything as the truth. So it's a very interesting thing to witness, because more and more I can observe that people with fewer expertise just tend to now be nearly dominating the market. I don't know if it's the same on the continent. I don't know if it's the same in Australia where you are, Karina. I don't know if it's a very just Irish thing at the minute, but it is an Irish thing at the minute. And I've had a few conversations with people, you know, about this and their capacity to kind of witness elements of it as well. So yeah, going back to the length of a teacher training, if you're delivering a 200 hour, I would kind of think that the amount of hours training that you've completed should be far greater, far, far greater, maybe 10 times greater. but again, personal perspective, right? Personal perspective, not fact.
Yeah. Something that really influenced the culture in Australia was the trauma sensitivity awareness. Mm. So we had a really big wave of trauma sensitivity training, and I don't know if it was necessarily as informed as kind of understanding skeletal variation, but I think it, especially with the political correctness terror of offending people that's sort of globally prolific, I think what that actually did for flow classes and asana classes in Australia was there was way more mindful questions being asked in class. How does that feel? Do what feels comfortable, which is nice. You know, it's a good start. I see some eye rolls there. What I definitely saw there, though, and I know I've changed the track a little bit in our conversation, was I saw a lot of new teachers just really afraid to commit to say anything.
Yeah.
Because of that fear of upsetting someone, you know, not wanting to get too colorful with their language or too descriptive in case someone was triggered, and leading every sentence with a perhaps or a maybe, and just handing it over to people to the point where there really wasn't much guidance. And I know that the pendulum will always swing back and forth, but then I'm also really pleasantly surprised. I was really lucky because I had done all of my skeletal, well, I had done a fair amount of skeletal variation training, and I was the anatomy teacher at our college. So okay. I had the real privilege of people coming through their basic 200 hour or 350 hour to kind of unpack a lot of myths around the absolute cues of right and wrong that had been the stock standard in the Australian yoga culture, which was great. And so many light bulbs went off in people's minds, and so much more inquiry was going on. And I was really proud of that. I was really happy with that. And when I do occasionally go to a public class, I'm often really impressed that there is a lot more nuance being offered for people to actually explore more of what the intention could be of a posture, rather than this goes here, this goes here, this goes here, five breaths, move on. I'm really happy about that. Did the trauma sensitivity wave make it over to Ireland?
Oh God, it did. Oh, it absolutely did. And you know, it's interesting to look at it, because trauma informed, I've recently come to understand that many people who claim they are trauma informed are really just very informed by their own trauma, and not necessarily. That's a very interesting distinction, because, and of course, there's so much in this, Karina. You're absolutely right that it did allow for more nuance, but it allowed for nuance without boundaries, which led to an almost, like you said, an absolute fear of saying anything. And actually, trauma informed now, I think, is seen to make to mean comfortable. No instruction, no guidance, no rules. And we don't even now use the imperative anymore. We don't even give instructions in class. We just kind of do this mish of kind of inhaling and bringing your arms up, and if it suits you, and certainly don't put yourself out, and only if it feels comfortable. Only if it feels comfortable. There are times when a body and an organism that has not learned how to actually feel anything at all, everything is going to be uncomfortable. Everything is going to be new. And I think so much of this trauma-informed speak has ultimately just led to maintaining people in a dissociative state from their body's responses, from their body's sensations. And that's what we have anyway. COVID and this pandemic has, I think, genuinely left a vast majority of us in a state of excessive protection and somatic dissociation of some kind. And the capacity to actually recognize and sense how we're feeling, and the amount of times you'll even ask people where they're feeling something, how, you know, and they genuinely don't know. They genuinely can't connect to it. Now, when that's the case, when that's the kind of standard, the first task for teachers is a gentle befriending of the body sensations again. Now, that to me is at the heart of trauma-informed yoga as it's taught. A befriending of sensations is very different to making everything comfortable. Befriending sensations means you befriend the whole palate. And yes, you do so in a staged way, and you teach about pendulation, and you teach about moving in and out, and you talk about the resourcing the nervous system, and you make sure that you include skills and exercises that help students do that. But what tends to happen, because people do a 6-hour trauma-informed training, you know, that's pre-recorded, and a CPD offering, and that's what they do, and they come away and they think they're now, I've just been certified in trauma-informed yoga, and I'm like, the hell you have, in 6 hours, give me a break. But that is the nature of these waves of yoga. When they land, they become packaged in such short ways that they can only be diluted and reduced to a few, 3 takeaways, if you're lucky. And you're very lucky if those 3 takeaways are actually worth taking away. Generally, those takeaways tend to actually not even be helpful or accurate. But yeah, to go back to your question, trauma-informed is now the dominant discourse, and I would say a huge contributor to the excessive rise in even more spiritual bypassing, but now done under the guise of a trauma-informed approach.
Yes.
That's another chat, Karina.
We'll put a pin in that one, Grace.
I feel like that we'll have to come back to that.
We'll do this again. I'm sure we'll do another one of these. I would love to. Something that just came up for me when you were talking about that, and you have such a beautiful way with words. I could listen to you all day, you're such a beautiful teacher. Is the skill of, which is an ongoing skill that we're building as a teacher, with whatever kind of yoga you're teaching, but I think particularly in a yin space, is that skill of a teacher to be able to sit and steady oneself when you have perceived or confirmed discomfort happening in the room. And how that affects you, and you, and what you might omit, or what you might try and rush over to soothe, or how you might doubt your own ability. And, you know, that's coupled with the ability to give silence and stillness, which is often a terror for teachers to have any spaces or gaps. And maybe that's the piece that, you know, maybe that's the piece that is missing sometimes when people have done these quick 6-hour trauma-informed trainings, and there's such a hesitancy to ruffle any feathers. And I just want people to be comfortable, because I've sort of been told that every single person in the room is dealing with extreme trauma that I'm unaware of. And if I just, you know, if I walk past them too quickly, people are gonna blow up. That's such a responsibility for people to take on board. And the other thing that the first thought that I ever had when a good friend of mine who really got into the trauma-informed scene was explaining to me the philosophy, for lack of a better word, or the framework. And I just thought to myself, not that this is necessarily our job as teachers, but how do people heal if they never come close to their trauma again? What are we doing? Are we wrapping them in cotton wool?
Yeah, that's bubble wrap. Yeah. I couldn't agree more with everything you've just said there, very beautifully as well. And you know, the answer is that I'm not even sure that in my 100 hour yin training that I can give any more than the firmest foundations in this. I like to think, and I really do believe, that I offer very firm foundations to people, plus the support ongoing afterwards to really settle into this. But it would be an absolute lie to say that anyone can be taught in months or in weeks how to hold space for discomfort within, because what's incredible is that ultimately this is where, you know, shadow work and my particular, you know, preference for dealing with that at least a little before going into any sort of trauma-informed teachings, this is where it comes from, because the yoga world is full of people who want to help, full of people who want to heal, full of people who genuinely believe that they can be healers, a word that I run in the opposite direction whenever I hear someone using it. Now, if you are so hell-bent on helping and healing someone else, I can tell you without any shadow of a doubt, you are going to not want to look at your own stuff. Mm-hmm. Because genuinely, I believe that need to help is born of an inability to look at your own shadow in the first place. And that's a kind of a statement that I probably, you know, I might listen back to this and go, Grace, you could have said that with a little bit more nuance. And maybe I could say it with a bit more nuance. But I can see a parallel. The more someone comes to me and says, I really want to teach yoga because yoga really helped me and I want to help others, I would put money on it that that person is going to struggle most when I engage them in a little bit of shadow inquiry. If someone comes to me and says, I love yoga, it's helped me integrate a lot of things in my own experience, and I do want to share it with others, but I also mainly want to do this course to enhance my own practice, to learn more about myself, they're gonna, you know, find it easier. No one finds it easy, But it's going to be an easier path, perhaps, to look a little bit at all the aspects, maybe of ourselves that we have gone into the bag of tricks behind us that we prefer not to look at. This ability to deal with the silence and the stillness and the discomfort of others is absolutely influenced by the ability you have to be in silence and stillness with your own discomfort. And that has to be the first. That has to be the core of any yin teacher's teaching, is their own practice and their own embracing of their practice as the place of greatest teaching and greatest learning for them, you know, as they grow.
Yeah, I'd like to think that the more that people commit to their teaching, the more that they realize that they are practicing when they teach in that way, that they're not on their mat doing their own sequence and indulging, but they're noticing their own discomfort that rises when somebody is doing something else or fidgeting or struggling, or they perceive them as struggling, but really they're just sieving around looking for the sweet spot. And that's actually the work right there, is sitting in that space and going, I'm in my head making up all sorts of stories about what I think is going on over there. I've totally lost my ground. How do I actually regulate myself in this moment so that I can transmit a nice steady frequency back out into the room, rather than sort of co-regulating with who I think is spiraling out in the room and all the things that happen from there. So in that stillness, there's so much potency. There's so much, as you would well know.
And yes.
So many
yes.
teachers are terrified. Like so many budding teachers will say to me, I know I'm talking too much. I don't know how to stop talking so much. How do I lean into the silence? Like, well, just stop.
I often suggest to people, because I use egg timers a lot in my teaching, I say, start off with a minute. Just turn over the minute egg timer and say, I'm not talking for a minute. And do just little, like test yourself, or even 30 seconds, you know, even take it down to something that feels manageable. And another tip, I suppose, can be to have a hand on the belly and just be very, very aware of how the words that do come up, when they come up, tend to be very, very connected to this deep ill at ease, whether it's a hole, whether it's an absence of sensation or a density or something in the belly that you can't sit with in silence. And so the easiest way to distract yourself from it is to say something about the other people's experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what you said, oh, sorry, Grace, go ahead.
No, I was done.
I really resonate with what you said before, you know, when you said I might watch this back and think, oh gosh, I was a bit bold in that statement. I completely agree. And I wanted to add to that and say, oftentimes I notice that in the tendency of people that want to rush and help another the most, there's like a conscious or an unconscious desire that through that helping of other, their own healing will just kind of magically happen. And they might not even realize, you know, the deep feeling people, the very empathetic people, the people who maybe grew up with a lot of, you know, discomfort in the family home or whatnot, that there's just this need to quench the inner tension that they have in their own body and psyche by quenching somebody else's tension.
Yes. Yes. And you know, many of these teachers as well, Karina, have actually been sold the idea that yoga is going to heal their trauma. You know, that yoga is, and many people, and I would be the first person to talk about how yoga can be instrumental in a therapeutic setting, but there's so much more to flesh out on that. Whereas I think what we have now, we have a dominant discourse that where the words trauma informed have become so commonly used, but so misunderstood and so diluted that there is this notion, oh, there's stuff that I actually need to deal with. But instead of going to a therapist, instead of actually going to work through this on a one-to-one level, and I mean I'm a big believer in both. It just there's a sense that yoga will kind of help you maybe get there, but ultimately you're not getting to the root. You are only tending to the flowers or the weeds, but not extracting anything at the root. And I think that is sadly the state, the reality in many yoga practices that are titled trauma informed. But trauma informed does not mean trauma resolving, or does not mean trauma integrating, because that's what we do, right? I mean, if trauma is this state of dysregulation in the nervous system, if it's what happened in the body as a result of an experience, it's a state of dysregulation, or it's a state of dissociation where one cannot be with those sensations in the body. Now, if that's what trauma is, then the process of trauma healing or trauma integrating, you have to meet those sensations again. It stands to reason that nothing can be healed without being met. And that is, it's like the elephant in the room that sometimes I kind of think, like, how is this not clear? How is this so easily disregarded in the whole trauma discourse that you can kind of take yourself out of the body and heal your trauma? Nonsense. Nonsense. It's go further in.
Yeah, go further in.
Go further in.
And
Yin, go further yin.
go further in, and ho hopefully in a setting with somebody who is extraordinarily skilled to hold that container, maybe in more of a one-on-one setting. Yeah.
Yes. And maybe with a somatic psychotherapist, or maybe with somebody who is maybe somebody who has a skill set that extends beyond yoga training, actually.
Yeah.
I really believe that the future is in the bridging of worlds that have hitherto, and you're so beautifully already doing this, but we need more. We need more bridging of worlds, bridging of the wisdom of TCM, bridging the yoga, bridging the nervous system regulation insights, bridging internal family systems and knowledge of how parts can be identified in our practice, bridging the unconscious and talk therapy and accessing it, which is massively not touched on in a lot of yoga practices. So the bridging of worlds, and the bridging of worlds can only be done by facilitators who have the language to speak to more than one world at a time, to kind of, in the way that you're teaching and sharing, include a vaster landscape for exploration than the one little world on its own can offer.
Yes.
Maybe.
I feel similarly when I see posts on, say, like the Yin Yoga Network, which is an amazing Facebook group, where people go there and they say, what's the best yin yoga posture for fibromyalgia? Or what can someone show me a liver meridian sequence
Oh,
because I have migraines? Or I mean, I've written quite a bit about that, and it's kind of a bit of a segue, but sometimes people try and bridge the paradigms together, but they've only got one lens that they know how to look through. And I don't know if you've got some thoughts about this in the yin world. It's almost like there's this strange idea that yin yoga is Chinese medicine, and that meridians must be incorporated into yin yoga.
Oh,
But
yeah.
if you start to do that and you've only learnt a little bit, And I often wonder if I should teach it at all, because it's so enormous and people can only grasp small bits, and then they try and make all these connections, and then perhaps all that's happened is somebody's come out of a class and now they're just extremely concerned about their liver.
Yes, I know. So much
conversation about it.
Yeah.
And luckily people chime into those threads on Yin Yoga and they say, you should really go and see a physician, or you should really go and get that checked out.
Go and see an acupuncturist.
Yeah, go and see an acupuncturist. Go and speak to someone who's got medical training. Well, you know, a yoga practice is like a beautiful irrigation flush for the whole energetic system of the body, but it's not a replacement for an actual diagnosis or a treatment plan.
No. And it's incredible that Yin Yoga Network. Oh, dear. I mean, I really have to limit exposure to it, because there are quite a few people on it who just see it as a way to share, you know, just see it as a way to share their offerings and have a very, you know, have a very kind of strategic way of using it. And if somebody has put together a short course, well, you know, probably 2 hours on, you know, yin yoga for the meridians. And, you know, I'm putting together a free course, or I'm putting together a course. Do you want it while it's still free? And I know, comment below, and then, like, you know, 375 comments later. That's just pure tactic. Like, how can people not see through that? That is, you know, that is just somebody who desperately wants to get way more clients. And instead of kind of saying, you know, here's the link, go and get it, they say comment below in order to increase the engagement. And it's just something I've really noticed an awful lot now, like this need to, it's very self-serving. And I mean, I get it. People are trying to share their wares, share their work. But it's just led to Yin Yoga Network not really being a place of much value, I don't think, anymore. Like, it's not a place of learning. It's just a place of people offering their freebies. And ultimately, as far as I'm concerned, if you do not believe your work should be paid for, then I don't even understand why you're doing it. It is great to want to share your work with the world, but bigger picture here, offering things for free, and there's been a real increase in this of late. Even I don't know if it's the same in Australia, but in Ireland there has been a number of trainings recently where there have been free spots or two for one. And I always think, God, how funny. Imagine if, like, if the accounting board, the accountancy board, or the carpentry, you know, association in Ireland started saying, you know, the next intake for carpenters is two for one. Bring a buddy and you can both train to be carpenters. Or I think it's just ludicrous. Like, but somehow yoga teachers seem to, you know, there's a sense that we should all be able to be a yoga teacher. And if you can't pay for it, that's all right. We'll give you a scholarship because the world needs more yoga. Well, the world might need more yoga, but we certainly don't need more teachers who are trained on a course that you thought was lacking in value so much that you had to offer free spots for it.
Yes, there's definitely a quality control sweep that needs to come through. And I'm so impressed that you are, and you can tell us a little bit about it, this next step that you've taken to now bring all of the incredible nuance of, like, your own body and your own skeletal variation and actually getting to know your own self, and then bringing that, what I think, you correct me if I've got this wrong, and then bringing that back into the flow space.
Yeah.
With your functional training, your school, if I'm not wrong, you're creating a school.
That's it. Yes. The International School of Functional Yoga Teachers, which is ISFIT, which rhymes very beautifully with misfit. And that's, it's not, you know, that is on purpose because of the way that I feel in many ways. Functional approach, you know, teachers, we are still kind of the, you know, we're the yoga misfits in a way. Now this is changing, This is definitely changing, but skeletal variation, if you take, I suppose, the yoga world globally as a whole, and look for evidence of skeletal variation awareness, I think you're still talking about a small minority of classes that would have cueing and language that is not based around notions of correct and incorrect alignment.
Yes.
And certain rules, that are not going to work for everybody. So the decision to start up a school, is twofold. A, I felt it was needed for my own yoga teacher training plans, and B, I spent and have spent many years in a school, and I only resigned a couple of months ago from my school teaching job. I taught French and music for many years. And actually, in more recent years, as yoga teaching and the training of teachers was taking up a bigger place in my life, I couldn't do it all. I really couldn't do it all. It was the I liked to think I could, and certainly at the beginning, I definitely thought I could. But it really led to quite a severe case of just having my priorities totally in the wrong order, and my personal life really suffered actually in that quest to bring the body of work into the world. And so bringing the body of work into the world, I realized A, I couldn't do it alone, and B, I didn't want to. I really want and desire for this to be a global and international and a collective network. And it starts the pathway start off with yin. The 100-hour art of yin training is the first path, the first step on the path for the 200-hour functional yoga as therapy and beyond for 300 and 500-hour programs. But the adding of the yang, like you said, the flow, the hatha, adding that was not never necessarily my intention to begin with. That was an absolutely a response to students' requests. It came about because, I mean, I could nearly predict the timing of it, and students will do yin with me, and I was unique enough in that it was pretty much all I taught, or it was majoritarily what I taught, and they would come back and they'd say, loving yin, loving teaching yin, but I'm still teaching hatha, I'm still teaching flow, and either one of two things: either I don't like teaching it anymore, or I still like teaching it, but I know I'm saying things that are not wrong, but I know I'm saying things that are not inclusive of everybody in the room. I know I'm still giving cues that are stuck in my head from my 200-hour training, and I don't know what to give as alternatives. The extension of target areas, sensation-based teaching beyond the yin world was the path I found myself on in order to create this curriculum, which together, the art of yin and the art of yang, is a 200-hour functional yoga training. And I believe, I could be wrong about this, but I don't think I am. I believe it's the only one worldwide that actually includes yin and yang, because I know that there exists. I know the fat yogis, for example, they had a 200-hour training, which was kind of functional vinyasa, but it was only vinyasa. Whereas I think the uniqueness about the training that ISFIT has is that it is designed for people who really want to teach more than just yin, but want to bring the principles of skeletal variation, of teaching to enhance interoception, because that is the foundation for trauma-informed teaching, as opposed to a kind of a general lens of let's keep everybody comfortable and wrapped up in cotton wool so that we never, A, never teach them anything and they never feel very much. So look, it's early days. It's early days, Karina, but I'm thrilled so far with the response, and people are really coming around to it. You know, they start with the yin and then they're like, oh yeah, now I totally now see how I need to go back to my sun salutations, how I need to go back to my yang practice and deconstruct in order to kind of get a clearer functional lens on it. So yeah, that's where it all came about.
Amazing. Congratulations. What a huge feat. So impressed.
Thank you. Yeah, a long time coming.
Yeah. Well, people come out of our yin trainings, right? And they're a little bit, you know, they're out on the fringes with us now, and they often have a moment of shock. How can I go back to class now? I'm going to be analyzing everything that's said. How do I teach my flow class next Sunday? How do I re-enter my practice with all this new information and a pulling down of all of these old beliefs and structures around the binary of the way yoga is taught? And I think I've tapped into what you described at the beginning of the chat, this sort of the bigger muse or the bigger energetics around this idea coming into manifest. And I've touched it a couple of times and had a few ideas of smaller 25-hour functional anatomy programs, but they've just never actually come forward into being. I had one that I was going to do, but then, as you say, one of my very good friends calls it the great unpleasantness. When the great unpleasantness descended upon the world, so many things got shelved.
Yes.
So I think it's wonderful. And I love that in your program, people start with the yin.
Yes.
And then there's the flow, then there's the yang.
Yes. And it is the only. Yes. It is the only thing that I'm really a bit of a stickler about. I mean, everything else within my teaching and I suppose even my approach, I love to discuss perspectives. I love to be wrong, actually. I love to have a conversation and to change and to have my mind changed, not to have my mind changed, but to actually change my mind as a result, you know, as a result of new information, and that to me is this constant learning is kind of really why I'm doing this. And that weirdly, the starting with yin came about because of the resistance that people have to the practice. And I think I thought to myself, well, you know what? I'm not willing. I want there to be a sense that the teachers that I work with, that those who are drawn to this work, drawn to this practice, that they do understand that they're going to meet themselves on a deeper level. And I need there to be an agreement. Just that they're willing, not that they're happy about it, not that they're leaping up and down with joy, because of course we resist the truth. You know, we resist greater self-knowledge. I mean, ultimately, I think the ego is and its defenses are so anchored to keeping us safe, and we understand and we throw it out periodically how our greatest freedom, you know, exists on the other side of fear, and we must get to know our resistance and we mustn't let it stop us. But I wonder, do people really understand what that means? Because if we accept that to be true, then it does mean that we're kind of embracing, or at least turning our face towards a life where there is some struggle. There is going to be that edge, to use that yin term. That edge is going to be there. And ultimately, are you willing to sit a little bit closer with it, to it, for a while? That's all I need from teachers and students who come to work with me. Everything else I can teach, everything else I can work with. But it is very hard to work with people who will not look at themselves.
Yes.
Yeah. That's hard. I mean, it can be done, but it's not pleasant. And any time, it's luckily it's happened very, very, very rarely. And normally that's why discovery calls are really great, because you get to chat, you know, and I'll always, you know, people should always be practicing. And if ever anyone contacts me about training, my first comment will always be, join me for practice. And you know, my new approach with trainings is actually to have a system whereby people are practicing with me for months beforehand, because it means that when we get to the training stage, there is the capacity to go so much deeper. They have already encountered their edge. Even if it's just a weekly yin practice, it means that regularity is there, so that when they come to drop into the training, there is a readiness, and the body has felt things already, so that not everything is going to feel like it's kind of so new.
And I bet a lot of ideas, perhaps new ideas, have had some time to permeate a little bit in that months of preparation as well. Just to, you know, sowing some seeds.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you to touch on something that we were chatting about before we press record. And it was something really potent that you said when you were talking about, you know, when you were talking about priorities being really mismatched as you were doing all this profound work as a solo being and creating this enormous thing for the world, this gift for the world. And you mentioned about, you know, the state of anxiety that kind of was rumbling along, I'm using my own words here, rumbling along as you're doing that work, and how that can almost become a sense of normalcy, or a, you know, your daily average state. And I feel like that's most people. That is most people. And some people that have had the courage to actually say it to me, that encountered that a lot, have been the ones that have said, with quite a lot of vitriol in their voices, "Karina, I hated yin. The first time I did yin, I hated it." And then something inspires them to come back.
Yeah.
One student, the reason that she came back is because she did a class with me in a lecture, and I offered rebounds in the class, and she'd never encountered rebounds before. And it changed the whole experience. She's like, I didn't know that was part of the class. I'm like, I'm not sure if the person you went to class with had training. That's my thought about that. But then they actually come to say they love it. They end up teaching it. And there's this huge flip. And I wonder if you might speak to that a little bit.
Yeah. So there's two things in that, I suppose. There's the experience of anxiety as something that we get so used to that it becomes our comfort, our blanket. And I don't think we'd put that term on it, but I think that what can happen is that the experience of actually not being anxious about something can be more panic-inducing than the low-level state of constant striving and high alert and what's next that I have to be aware of, this state of constant kind of arousal. You know, when I first experienced anxiety on a kind of a deep level, it really took a huge amount out of me, because I think in the past I would have had little brief bouts of kind of depression, or what at the time I certainly would have considered depression. My experience with my mental health was always on that kind of like that kind of darkness, maybe, that would persist for a while. And I hesitate to even use the word depression, because I think you might just call it an extended state of low mood. When I got anxiety, it was a visceral kind of a waking in the middle of the night, kind of sweats, palpitations, heart racing experience of anxiety that kind of gripped me. And, you know, at the time, I believe it served a hugely important purpose of alerting me to work that I was not doing, notably the work that I have, I suppose, maybe done in the last couple of years. And Carl Jung has, many, many fabulous quotes on this, but one in particular: your anxiety always points out your task. And he also has one around like neuroses. Like, a neurosis is a substitute for legitimate suffering. Now, this neurotic kind of state of anxiety, which is, as you said, so many people, the neurotic state of anxiety is very often a more comfortable alternative to actually getting to the next level of dwelling in the truth of who we are, because that's going to maybe uncover something that we're not aware of. But we've become now aware of this state of anxiety. There's something familiar about it. It's manageable. You can temper it. And a lot of people, and certainly I would have had, oh, sure, look, I'll have a drink. There's so many ways that that you can kind of numb it a little bit, that we can actually get used to, that you can get used to managing it. It's a very interesting thing, because I think it's so functioning. I mean, it didn't affect me in my life sufficiently for me to get massively worried about it. What I did understand was that underneath that anxiety was a deep, I'm going to call it a belly or a soul knowing, that I needed to leave school so that I could set up my own. That I needed to cut a cord with that aspect of my life. I will always be a teacher. There's a profound teaching element at the core of who I am. But who you can be as a teacher in a school, and who you can be as a teacher and founder of a school, mm-hmm. are two different realities. Mm-hmm. And I genuinely believe that the manifestation of anxiety within my experience was the last resort from a body that was sick of giving me subtle signals that I was refusing to listen to. And this was the warning alarm bell going, Grace, get out, get out, get out, get out, get out. And so I really believe that the anxiety that developed in me was serving the purpose of getting me to take the task that I knew I had to do, to grab it, to seize it, to let this body of work come through me, to take the risk, to walk away from the permanent pensionable job, even though I had no guarantee that anything was going to work. And then to add on top of that, the decision to return back to train as a psychotherapist. So now I'm also a student. So there was just, I think, all of that came together to give me an experience of deep knowing in my body that anxiety, yes, it's an awful experience, but it is a substitute for a greater truth or awareness that I think we have to be maybe willing, that we're maybe not willing to look at. Does that make sense?
It does. And what I heard in that is that for you, that anxiety, the recognition of that anxiety, was also an invitation to change.
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. It was a signal. It was an invitation. It was an opportunity, actually. Beneath the anxiety, there was an invitation. And I wonder whether that might not be true for many of us. It's a great journaling question. Like, what is the invitation beneath the anxiety? Weirdly, I'm convinced that people can hear that in yin. I think that's what yin can actually offer us is a capacity to see the anxiety, to navigate it, but to also understand that the anxiety is just an easier reality to the kind of invitation that's laying deeper in the body, and that when you come to stillness at your edge for some time and you have some silence, it's only a matter of time before that invitation becomes easier to touch, to hear. And that's yin's genius. And that's why the rebound. I'm on a roll now, but just to go back to the rebound thing that you'd said, like it breaks my heart when it's left out. Because that for me, rebound is the integration, realization, moment of truth, where you get to maybe hear that question, where you get to kind of sense it, and to rob people of that. And I don't think people don't do it intentionally. You know, if they're not trained in rebound, then they're not going to teach it. But that's why it's so important to find yourself a teacher trainer who is functionally trained, so that they're going to offer the rebound, so that you can really understand why yin is so much more than yoga, in that it has already contained within it the opportunity for the therapy, the integration, the realization, the merging of the opposites. It's actually through our capacity to hold those aspects that seem contradictory that we can become also the place where they merge together and become something new, become something different, become the next stage, the next evolution, the next chapter.
And in a world where I'm really inspired by Cal Newport. I don't know if you've read any of Cal Newport's work.
No, but I will.
He's sort of in the tech space, and he writes, he's
Okay.
got an amazing book called Deep Work and another book called Digital Minimalism. And a
Okay.
concept that he talks about a lot is that we don't get any solitude anymore because we can constantly avoid our boredom or our solitude by pulling our phones out of our pockets. And in yin yoga, when you were saying before, when that state of anxiety or whatever the discomfort is arises and we can't meet it, we don't have the skill to meet it, there's nothing in the world that we would like less than to meet it, and we can go and have a drink with a mate, or we can avoid. You can't
Yeah.
really avoid in yin, and it's
No.
this solitude that's not really available much at all in people's lives. And I think that's also the power in it. I was listening to somebody yesterday talk about, their thoughts about the power of acupuncture, and they were sort of positing that it's not necessarily the needles doing the work. It's that at some point in an acupuncture treatment, a patient or a client is with themselves and you leave the room. Whereas you might not get that with a massage, you might not get that with body work where there's constant stimulation and interaction. But at some point, you are left to be with you, your thoughts, your whatever it is that happens in that space, and that's actually where the potency is. And I think that's why I love these two spheres so much, in that I see so many similarities between what happens in the yin space and what can happen in the acupuncture space.
Yeah, absolutely, Karina, 100%. And that solitude and silence, you know, and I think that that's why I was so drawn to Vipassana meditation. You know, I did my first one actually in Australia, in Tasmania, and that experience of silence for 10 days, like that experience of no phone, no stimulation, no reading, no writing, no distraction, it's the most profound and intense, experience of you with you, and all coming to understand the nature of the mind, and coming to understand also like how bloody boring and unoriginal at times it was. It's like the profound disillusionment I remember after my first Vipassana was like, My God, I just keep having the same thoughts over and over and over again. And I think I had this lovely, lofty notion that, you know, there was going to be so many amazing ideas in there, and I was going to discover just how brilliantly original I was. And I'm certainly there were like, you know, you would get kind of moments of insight for sure, but there was an awful lot of just this kind of controlling part of the mind, which just like, you know, that goes round and round in a narrative, like a hamster on a wheel. And you realize when you see that, you realize that's your life. That is the voice in your head constantly keeping you safe, predicting everything, commenting on everything, narrating everything, interpreting everything, going round and round and round and round and round. There is no space for you. Unless you put yourself in a situation where you choose it. And it's hard to choose it because, as you said, it's much easier to numb than it is to actively be
Lean in.
with. Yeah, lean in. Yeah.
I've done one Vipassana, and my memory of it is just that it was really hard work. It was hard work to not go into the deep recesses of my mind and escape the moment and come back and do a few more laps and come back and do
100%.
the
Yes. But you
Yeah.
know, it was funny. I definitely had at least one, if probably something like five different sits, like 1 hour sits over the course of the first 10 days, where I was happily in my alternative reality land. And it was just fascinating. Like, I mean, I was designing my dream house, and I was going through the color of paint that was going to be on the walls. I was imagining myself rich and famous, and the books that I'd have a library. Like, it was just comical. And I mean, I can laugh about it now in hindsight, but like at the time, I was in disbelief. I was like, was I just in fantasy land for a full hour when I was supposed to be attending to reality in the present moment? Well, yes, Grace, yes, you were. And in fact, you will continue to do that on many other occasions. So it's humbling and interesting, and also really, really important to understand that if you don't seek to go beyond that's the limitation. That is where you will live. You will live in those stories until you see them for what they are, you know.
Yeah, on a hamster wheel, going round and
Flat,
round.
round and round and round. Yeah, until you're dizzy. So, yeah, getting off it and pausing. That's why to pause is a radical act, you know, to
Yes.
stop and to come to stillness these days really is a radical act. So, I always think it's good when people come to yin, I say, like, well done. That's a courageous decision.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. I see yin yoga as a revolution and almost like a
Yes.
political statement against life. Like everything
Absolutely.
about life
Yeah.
gets flipped on its head when you come to yin.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, one day maybe one of us, maybe me, maybe I should take on a bigger project, will write like a big philosophical musing about yin yoga and how it's this antithesis to a life that's just grinding people into a mortar and pestle until they're just dust. That's how I feel.
Absolutely, absolutely. And when you realize, I think it can be also, you know, when we can, I guess, sometimes feel like our arguments are so countercultural. Like, I mean, there is a real activist in me, luckily, because and probably and definitely in, I think there's an activist at the heart of yoga, of yin yoga teachers who really commit to it, who commit to it as a practice, who commit to it as part of their teaching. There has to be a bit of a revolutionary in there, because what we are teaching is so countercultural, so not what the dominant lens and arguments are. And that is in itself a very lonely place to be sometimes. I think it's a very it's part of my own journey that I'll speak about openly. It can be very lonely. It can be very lonely to feel like you're the body of work that you're kind of, I suppose, bringing forward. And I still repeat what I said earlier, that it's coming through me. It's coming through me as a kind of a collective gesture rather than anything that's my creativity. But it's lonely. It is easier, I believe, to have something to say which is already accepted as the norm. It is not easy to feel like your work constantly leads you to being a bit like, but what about this? But what about this? But have you considered this? And all I kind of take from that as a kind of a comfort as well sometimes is that there are more and more people kind of coming around who will message and kind of say, God, you're really speaking to me, Grace. And they'll say often, which I have to love for the honesty, I love your work, Grace. I'm not ready for it yet. And I find it so beautifully honest. And it always comes with a bit of a tinge of, because I go back to an old story about being too much. I have a very old belief about being a bit too much for the world, for people. And I think when people often when any whenever there's any sort of a reference to things being too much to consume right now, I take from it a kind of a sense of, I'm too much for people, but also a really heartwarming awareness that the person is kind of able to say, I'll be with you in a year or two, or when I'm ready, when I'm at that place, I'll find you. And I think that's for me, that's leadership. And then I kind of settle into more of a, you know what, Grace, leaders can feel lonely because they're often on a path where they're kind of saying, come along, and people are kind of going, hell yeah, or they're going, never in this lifetime. And then there's a few in the middle who are going, yeah, but next year. And that's, listen, that's fantastic. Fantastic,
Well, I hear in that someone's really keen, but they're not quite ready to tip their box over and take all the things out that they were clinging to that they knew to be real or could rely on, and perhaps not have any of them go back in the box. Like, I'm just not quite ready to tip all my current belief systems out. That's a lot for me, but I'm gonna get there. And when I get there, it's going to
Absolutely.
be with you.
Yes, which is so beautiful, actually, and which is rather than kind of me hearing it, because I can tend to hear things through a negative lens too, and that comes with, here the too much belief, that rather than hearing it as, you're too much, but to hear it as, I'm not there yet, which is a very self-assured and very self-aware comment to even be able to make. So I think I and also reinforces that we're here as teachers, and we're here to put things out there to commit to creating and not to commit to being concerned about the outcome, but rather just the process of birthing the work. And not paying too much attention to people's responses to it, because when you do, you simply start to go into the trauma-informed practice of self-censorship, excessive political correctness. Let's not ruffle any feathers and keep people comfortable. And certainly, let's give them a good experience so they come back next week. So there you go. I guess that's
There
there you
Wow,
go.
what a beautiful kind of circling back to so many things that we've talked about in this chat. That feels like a really nice place to wrap it up.
It does. It does. Thanks a million. It's been a pleasure chatting to you.
Oh, such a pleasure. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and what you're doing on the other side of the globe. And, you know, well, we're recording this in July of 2023, but who knows, maybe in the future there might be some offerings that make it their way to Australia. We'll see how things develop.
Well, yeah, they're actually, yeah, in the works for summer 2024, which was actually will be your winter next year. Okay. There are some tentative plans, so stay tuned.
Yes. So for our listeners and our viewers, I'm going to pop all of Grace's details, her school link, and also her podcast, which is just brilliant. You need to add that to your listening list in the notes so you can check all of that out afterwards. Thanks so much, Grace.
Thanks a million, Karina. Bye. Take care.
Bye.